Afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order at 3:04 p.m. Thursday, January 27, 2022 in the Max Greenberg Room of the Capitol. We're moving incrementally towards punctuality by 2 minutes progress today. Members present from my left to my right, Representative Kaufman, myself, Chair Christ Tompkins, Representative Eastman, Representative Clayman, and on the line is Representative Tarr. And we have a quorum, and we will get going. And Representative Vance joined us also at 3:04 p.m., just after we gaveled in. Let's see here. As always, thank you to Sophie and Lydia for helping facilitate today's meetings, as well as my committee aide, Jeff Stepp, who makes this committee happen. And we have two items on today's agenda, SB 32 from Senator Stevens relating to college credit for high school students. Then we have House Bill 37 from Representative Wohl relating to income taxes. For SB 32, this is technically a second hearing, but as with some other legislation we will soon hear, the first hearing was last year, so memories may be foggy and faded. So today we will hear a sponsor, reintroduction from Senator Stevens and Mr. Lampkin. It can be slightly abbreviated. Please exercise discretion as you see fit. We'll also hear invited testimony from Dr. Paul Layer and Dr. Dina Bishop and take public testimony today as well. So with that, Mr. Lampkin and or Senator Stevens, please welcome to the committee. Come forward, put yourself on record, and feel free to, as it were, reintroduce the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stevens, District P. District P, you know, it's changed over the years, so it's confusing, but it is District P now. So, but I appreciate your comments about reintroducing you, because we went through a lot of hearings last year, and even for me, it's maybe back and get into this bill. But I think it's a very important bill, and I'm pleased you're listening to it. The data that we've got is that students who participate in middle colleges or dual credit programs find themselves having greater success in high school and going on and pursuing a life and post-secondary education. The purpose of the bill is not to micromanage things, but the University of Alaska and school districts may have an agreement consistent with individual district needs or interests and capability levels. The bill is designed to, move this over here. The bill is designed to provide a framework that is flexible in response to different needs in different areas of the state and really avoids a one-size-fits-all approach. We negotiated with the University of Alaska and with school districts last year and made several changes that I think improves the bill to make it better fit for stakeholders and managers. The goal, of course, is to scale it out to include more school districts, particularly in rural districts. There are some successes out there. Some districts are doing it, but not all. Just a couple of comments I'd make on. So you know that early and middle college students graduate when they go through this program at a rate of 93% nationwide compared to 78%, which is the national rate. Students of color make up 77% of students in early and middle college, 77%, and students from low-income families make up 57% of early and middle college students. And nearly a quarter of middle and early college graduates earn a post-secondary credential along the way with our high school diploma. And just one other comment I wanted to make, and of course I have Tim Lankin, who has worked diligently on this bill. It's an effort. Senate Bill 32 is an effort to recognize the accomplishments of 47 other states in establishing a state-sanctioned collaboration between secondary and post-secondary schools, encouraging students to finish high school and enter some form of higher education or professional training. And just a last comment. One thing that sort of has shocked me is through this COVID issue, how many students have disappeared? How many students have not come back? The problems we are facing. students now, many of them are satisfied with taking a job and earning some money rather than going on to graduate school, going to college. We have fewer students in college nationwide. And that's okay. I mean, it's certainly okay to have a professional career other than a higher education. But the problem is that they're not coming back to a higher education. And if you look at the stats over the years, it shows that young people that go on to college, get a degree, are happier, they're more satisfied, their lives are happier, they stay out of prison, they have longer marriages, and they're more successful. So young people today are stopping earlier than they have in the past, taking a job, which really keeps them from making money and doing fine, but they're not making the progress that they should and progress that will make them happier in life. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your tolerance here.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. I was also caught flat-footed. I might ask if you could just mask even when presenting, just to create a uniform and universal standard in the committee, because that's what I've been trying to do. Mr. Lampkin, do you have anything to add on the legislation for the committee's reference?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. I don't want to take up the committee's time. I'm happy to answer questions on the mechanics of the bill as it pleases the committee. I think the folks that really need to be doing the talking here are online, Dr. Bishop and Dr. Lair.
Great. Thank you very much. I might just see if there's any burning pants on fire questions from the committee, but otherwise, let's just proceed to invited testimony. Representative Eastman, a burning pants on fire question.
Thank you, and I think I'd like it to set it out here. If now's a good time to take it up, great. But my question is just going to be, obviously we're focused on the University of Alaska here, and I just wanted to know if the opportunities here are wide enough in scope that they could be taken up by other colleges other than the University of Alaska.
Great. Let's put that in the parking lot, but I think it's good to have that out for reference, and invited testifiers can also elect to speak to that, and of course the sponsoring staff can as well. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. Mine is related, but it's on the other side of it as far as other private homeschool, I know like it's baked right into the title, public school students, UA, but just if there's any opportunity that may be able to be discussed around that area. Thank you.
Okay, two questions for perhaps invited testifiers reference, and then we can circle back to for the sponsor as well. With that, let's go to Dr. Dina Bishop, who's online as an invited testifier. Dr. Bishop, if you can hear us, please go ahead, put yourself on record, and present your testimony. Actually, just before you do, I want to note for the record that Representative Story joined us at 3:09 p.m. So, Dr. Bishop, over to you.
Thank you. It's an honor to speak to the committee, and my name, again, is Dina Bishop, and I am the superintendent of the Anchorage School District. I'm honored to speak to you. Really back in 2012, the co-creator of the Alaska Middle College back in the Matanuska Sisseton-Borough School District, for which we then brought, as well, another opportunity to the Anchorage School District students. I want to share that it's a collaboration between the Anchorage School District and the University of Alaska Anchorage. We have, just to quickly answer some of the questions I've already heard, we have had students transfer into ASD, specifically from private schools, to be able to attend the Alaska Middle College. And the transfer in was made due to we're using BSA funding and that funding model to create a school that has the choice for college. And so it's Alaska's money going to Alaska schools. And to me, whether you're a private school student, parents in the community or public, these funds are through the BSA. But we work to successfully, for students to successfully complete college coursework that will result in earning both AFD high school diploma as well as credits towards college. Alaska Middle College School is a choice school for juniors and senior high school students presently in the two districts, but the bill does address younger students that are capable. They build college readiness to achieve success at college-level academics, and so I want to share that by having this school, we have built the capacity within our system as well to infuse more rigor and understanding in getting students to be successful in college, even those that remain with us through their regular diploma. Students in AFC who attend AMCS, or the Alaska Middle College, are going to college on the Anchorage main campus. And certainly with proper planning, AMC students have the potential to earn an associate's degree at the same time they earn their high school diploma. Many of them finish their general education requirements, or what the university calls GERs, for a BS or a BA degree as well. Please know that through all the years that I've done this through MACSU and Anchorage, again, since 2012, 10 years, 100% of the courses at UAA have been transferable to other universities if students graduate from Alaska and move outside. However, the best outcome is that every year of graduation, 72 to 78% of the students who graduated from MACSU or Anchorage while in the program stayed here to finish their undergrad degree, which is huge. And that speaks to the quality of the program. We get them there, UAA keeps them. Presently, just so you know, for the outreach to Bush, Alaska, we have partnered with the Lower Yukon School District and what they call the Kuselbeck Academy. Presently, we have two students from the Lower Yukon attending that academy, which then we partnership with to go to AMCS. So we are building capacity as the largest school district in the state to offer at really no additional cost. Actually, in some districts, it's less than half of their BSA to attend the Alaska Middle College. AMCS is also part of our new program called LitNow AK, where we're growing our own. It's a statewide academy supporting efforts to grow a diverse and local teacher workforce in Alaska. I'm just going to briefly touch on the power of AMCS. It has the power of the place. The model allows students with supports to learn on campus. There's two sides of support, one post-secondary and one, of course, secondary or high school. And we have some staff on our side. Our students must be college ready. We do not send students to UAA that are not college ready. And so they can be a part of AMCS and they're tutored by our teachers to pass the math and language or the SAT qualification to be in college level courses. So some of the feedback from students collected over time, the best feature is the increased sense of independence and responsibility, flexibility in their schedule, and the ability to get ahead in college. They reported their best resource was their ASC teachers and their most challenging classes were in math. That's probably not a surprise. They were aware, however, of the resources available to support them both emotionally and academically. Our parents tell us that the features of AMCS are the college environment for their students, the fact that they are challenged in their coursework and they can get a head start in college with it paid for while at the same time they're in high school. So being smart about using taxpayer money to help students transition from high school to college work. There have been hundreds of students throughout the years attending. We've ranged from about 220 up to 280 here in Anchorage. MACSU is about 150 to 170. The latest data I have is actually from 2019. 4,400 college credits were earned. The mean student that graduates earned 39. So that is quite a bit of college units paid for by the time they leave. But again, many students, if that's the mean, many students actually leave with over 60 credit hours. 55% of the class in 2019 earned the Alaska Performance Scholarship, and the tuition, books, and fees are no cost to parents because, again, we are smartly utilizing the BSA. And so I just wanted to share that and be online, able to answer questions. This is an excellent program, an excellent opportunity, and it can be done. We are at it about the third year now, and I'm hoping that it can move through because it does offer opportunities for students and our parents, whether they live in urban setting or a rural setting. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bishop. I'm going to maybe pause and see if there's questions from the committee before proceeding to Dr. Allaire. Questions for the committee from the committee for Dr. Bishop Representative Vance, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bishop, what kind of outreach do you make to the students and to the parents about being prepared to step into this program?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, that's a great question. Well, beginning at our freshman year, we are actually revamping and talking about college, career, and life readiness and taking the courses necessary. Their freshman and sophomore years, we, of course, want them to do the highest math that they can, and it's certainly ongoing. We begin in middle school to start to talk to our kids about preparing for high school and what a GPA is, but we do a big outreach their 10th grade year to share with them the opportunities about what AMCS can do and what's there so that parents and students can go in with their eyes wide open. Part of this opportunity being run to the point of really having a foot in high school and college is that these students remain attached to their high schools as well. What we found out through the years is that they like to be attached to their high school for prom, maybe a foreign language opportunity or a band orchestra, that they wouldn't have an opportunity necessarily in a cramped schedule in college. And so the outreach is great, and that essentially we're not trying to turn high school into college, and we're not turning college into high school. What we want to do is just provide great opportunities for kids.
One follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the passage of this bill and it having ninth graders the ability to take these college classes, how do you see any changes in that communication to earlier grades to help them prepare with their parents for the capacity to take college classes as a freshman? Obviously, it's a very different conversation than, say, a junior.
That is correct, and that is a great question. It really does start, it starts really early on with a great foundation in reading and skills as you move forward in being able to build capacity. Specifically, what we're doing in our own school district is working. We have a partnership now with the College Board in upping the rigor in all of our courses, and not necessarily the idea of rigor of being too hard for people, but having the outlook of letting every student know that we want to build competency in them to have either a professional track or a trades track in any pathway. And so we're building capacity, saying algebra 1 by 8th or 9th grade is important. But students that struggle, we've used the ALEKS exam for math as well as another APEC computerized program for summer to be able to tutor students that actually want this but haven't yet scored high enough. So basically, we've created individualized summer working groups, if you will, to help our students specifically meet the goals. But again, it would just move down and have students and parents believe in the concept, understand that it is attainable, and operationalize that through the supports and systems within the school district.
Great. Thank you.
Other questions for Dr. Bishop? Seeing none, Dr. Lehr, if you're online, please go ahead and put yourself on record and feel free to present your invited testimony.
Great. Thank you. For the record, Dr. Paul Lehr, Vice President for Academics, Students, and Research with the University of Alaska. Thank you, Chair Chris Tompkins, for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 32, an act establishing Alaska Middle College Program for Public Schools school students. I thank Senator Stevens for his support of this bill and also Superintendent Bishop for her partnership with our middle college programs in the Anchorage area and MATSU. As she noted, this has been a long partnership between school districts and the university, and we are very grateful for that opportunity. I testified to this bill last year, and as you know, this bill has been out for several years, and it's my pleasure to kind of give you the committee an update today on the progress we've made over that time to grow our programs to reach students not just simply in the more urban areas or in areas where we have our campuses, but throughout the state. So, again, dual enrollment programs provide an opportunity for students to earn college credit while meeting high school graduation requirements. One of the things I will note is that when a student completes a dual enrollment course with the University of Alaska and the school district, on their university transcript is that course. There is no asterisk, there's no star. A writing 111 class taken through the Alaska Middle College is writing 111 at the University of Alaska, full stop. So there is no issue of transferring to the university. And as Superintendent Bishop noted, courses from the university will transfer to universities outside the state as well. But our goal is, again, to keep as many Alaskans in the state as possible. Just as an update, as Superintendent Bishop noted, we've got over 200 students in our Anchorage School District Middle College program with UAA, another 150 or so with the MATSU District. And in fall 2020, we launched a dual enrollment middle college at Kenai Peninsula College, and that has about 33 students enrolled last fall, and we're seeing that one grow. In 2020, UAF launched a partnership with the North Star Borough School District here in Fairbanks to have students come on our campuses to take classes, and they had 40 students in that cohort, and we are looking to expand those. Those are all a lot of face-to-face classes, and even in the time of COVID, we are seeing a lot of interest in those. And again, those capitalize on our ability with our university centers and campuses for students to come on our campuses, experience the college environment, and take classes at the college level. However, we have a lot of school districts and students in areas where we don't have a campus for them to attend. And so several years ago, or last 2 years ago, I think, we launched what we call the Alaska Advantage Program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which is a virtual middle college program. And UAF and UAS are participating in this, and we have partnerships with over 40 school districts and homeschool programs in Alaska. And this is where we can reach homeschool students, is in areas where they can't come to campus, is that they can take classes through the University of Alaska, receive college credit, and it's a partnership between the university and the local district. The local district, wherever they are, or the homeschool, provides some support, some mentorship, some support for labs and other things, and the university will provide a college-level course for that program. We have over 400 secondary students in the program this semester, and we're looking at seeing this grow. And our Alaska Advantage students complete their programs and courses at a success rate of about 95%. So this has been very successful for us to partner with districts. And looking at the text of the bill, I can see that in section 1430.780B, the University of Alaska shall make the program available to each school district in the state. We are doing that. We have that program through the Alaska Advantage program, if there is no community campus for them, to contact us to work out the arrangement, the agreement between the district and the university to provide students an opportunity to get dual credit no matter where they are in the state of Alaska. And we are seeing more and more districts coming to us and working with us, both through our on-campus programs, as Superintendent Bishop noted, but also through our virtual middle college programs as well. Also anticipating, you know, some of the questions earlier from Representative Vance, we do have programs that are reaching into middle school or lower. ANSEP is a very good example of this. Some of our ANSEP programs, our middle school academy, and some of our other academies reaching students earlier in their careers in middle school and in high school so that they can be thinking about college as a possibility for them. That's really part of this, is to have students realize that they can do this. They can be successful in college, and they can and continue on. One of the things that Senator Stevens noted was the college going rate, and I was just looking at some statistics from the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education that said that for students who graduated high school in 2019, only 41% of those students in that class pursued higher education opportunities anywhere within the first year. Our students, our graduates from high school, are not going to college. And these programs that are in this bill are an opportunity for students to see that college can be for them, to look for those opportunities, and continue to go, to grow in those opportunities. Again, we do work to advise parents and students that this is your official college transcript, that you need to go into these courses aware that that is what's there for them. Also, that they must meet the prerequisites and the requirements that we expect all of the students in the University of Alaska to meet to be qualified for this class. So they must have the appropriate level of placement for a math class, for example, and be prepared to take it at that level. Again, we appreciate that with our partners with the school district, they provide tutoring and support and mentorship that makes this partnership work for all of us. And it's a great program, and I do appreciate and thank Senator Stevens for making this bill more visible in terms of the efforts. But even in the time that the bill has been discussed, we've seen more and more interest throughout the state from students, from parents, from districts, and we're looking to grow the program and expect more face-to-face as we come out of the COVID environment. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lehr. Questions from the committee? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins. Sorry to be late today and miss the beginning of your presentation. And also really wanted to thank Senator Stevens for championing this. I've had the privilege of going to visit with other legislators from education committees around the country, and they are really pushing this middle college and getting our credits to our high school students. So glad to have the emphasis here, because it is really important, and it's a great thing for kids and for our future workforce in Alaska. I was hoping that I could be a little bit reminded about the agreements that the university does with the school districts, and reminded, is there a negotiated rate that can be different for different districts, and is that based on virtual, or those cost different? If I could have a little bit of context about how that is done, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Story, I can address some of that. We do have different rates for district. The virtual middle college program is at a lower rate than our face-to-face middle colleges. And again, that reflects the amount of support that we have. With our middle colleges, like with Anchor School District and Mat-Su, the students are on campus. They are in classrooms with our regular students. And so the rate that we have and the agreements we have with the districts will reflect the higher cost associated with students being on those campuses. With our virtual middle college, there's a lot more support and partnership with the districts, and they provide some of that support. So the tuition cost has been reduced to encourage participation in those programs. I can provide the committee links and information about the agreements that we have, the various agreements that we have with Anchor School District, with Mat-Su, and with the virtual school districts that are the districts that we have the Alaska Advantage program with. But we do take into account the partnership we have with the district and how they can work with us and cost share, essentially, as we enter into these agreements.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What have you done to reach the students who may have fallen through the cracks as far as having interest in college that aren't normally the honor roll students and maybe hadn't given it a thought? Because the reason I ask this is my daughter and myself were both very nonchalant about high school. However, taking classes through the university, we excelled in the college classes more than we did in the high school because it just fit better. And now, it showed just a different atmosphere. And I wonder how many other students would be like that would excel in that. Do you have classes that you could offer that are less intimidating to those that may be unsure, may not show that they could excel in that, that aren't the normal high achievers.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, right now most of our agreements are for the college level, what we call 100 level or general education requirement classes. We don't offer the development classes through the Alaska Middle College programs. We are expecting students to come to us college ready, and so there's a lot of partnership that we have to have with the district on that. But again, these are mostly those classes that get students a footing within the university system. I would also point out that these courses, we're not intending to compete with AP for the senior level, the higher level students. These are classes that we're expecting, you know, students who would go into an undergraduate program or a workforce training program would have the skills for. And again, we have some of our courses and curriculum geared towards students who might be pursuing a certificate as well or an applied associate's degree. And so we're trying to broaden the breadth of classes that we have. And so it's not just simply math and English, but there are classes in some of the technical fields as well when we can offer those. I may perhaps Dr. Bishop has some thoughts on how they are reaching the students.
Dr. Bishop?
Yes. Hi, this is Dina Bishop, and I was hoping you would swing it our way. And this is an excellent question, and it's exactly what the Alaska Middle College is designed for, to assist in that prep. And what we found from our students is just like your experience and your daughter's, is that the motivation is there because it's that value and interest and the success breeds the success. But the Alaska Middle College is set up with some high school teachers on our side. So with our 230 kids that are in the middle college, we also have two teachers on our side. Some students are full college students. Some are only in English classes because they still need supports in math to build the competency to place in the ALEX exam to be in a college, you know, a credit-bearing course for a degree. And the power is in the place and the supports that they get. So that we really, and that was some of the student comments, that their biggest assets were the teachers on our side as the coaches and, you know, the support, especially for our first time going families that did not have a college graduate as a mom and dad. These, our folks on our side really allow that that insight and it's been termed that cultural capital to let them know, you know, about registration, about the opportunities, about, you know, how to request something appropriately as a college student. So the supports that you're talking about is specifically designed on the high school side of the Alaska Middle College, and they're needed. Some students utilize them more than others. Some students can get right in. But we also take a class. We call it the boot camp. And every college kid comes in and takes 3 hours, so their 3-hour course for credits, but a college boot camp that they actually learn the ins and outs of the not the content side of coursework and the constructs there, but all the other things that you kind of aren't told but just have to find out on your own, whether that's utilization of the library or where the financial aid is, how to utilize the platforms, and actually just building self-efficacy of speaking for yourself and being able to have a conversation with a professor and represent yourself well. So that's a great question, and that is specifically why the Alaska Middle College is so successful. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bishop.
Thank you. Quick question for me, I think for Dr. Lehr, is various school districts have been mentioned so far, KPB, Fairbanks North Star, Mat-Su, Anchorage. Are there other districts in the state of Alaska that are in some kind of dialogue or engagement with the UA system in setting up a middle college partnership? And I think I'm also going to specifically name or ask about Mount Edgecombe High School as well, given its effectively physical co-location or at least adjacency to the University of Alaska campus in Sitka.
Right. Thank you, Chair Chris Tompkins. We've had a long-standing relationship with Mount Edgecombe High School, given the proximity to our Sitka campus. And, you know, it existed almost as a middle college before there was a middle college. We had dual enrollment courses and programs with Edgecombe for many years, and students getting credit and coming over and using facilities. We are working on formalizing some of those agreements with the with those districts as we move forward. And again, for the virtual college, we're seeing more and more agreements. But with our where we have a footprint, where we have a campus, Kodiak is another area that we are seeing a lot of interest in growing the middle college model, and we're working on agreements there. And I can get you a detailed list of where we have those agreements. But you're absolutely right. There are opportunities. Sitka Ketchikan is another example where we are in close proximity to the high school there and have had a long tradition of courses that students have been taking for dual credit. We haven't established the formal middle college program there as far as I'm aware, but we have had students participating, and I envision that growing as these programs get established.
Thank you. Yeah, I had conversations with former Commissioner Ledoux when he was commissioner about the possibility of sort of piloting that middle college relationship with Mount Edgecombe, because I think there's arguably sort of more potential for any single secondary institution in Alaska with Mount Edgecombe High School than maybe anywhere else for a variety of reasons. I'd be interested and would appreciate if you'd be able to provide a list of districts where partnerships might be under incubation or sort of in the process to my office. I could share that with committee members, and also if it'd be possible to share any specific or substantive updates regarding University of Alaska conversations with Mount Edgecombe High School, and really when we're talking about Mount Edgecombe, we're talking about the state of Alaska Department of Education. So if that's possible, Dr. Lair, would really appreciate if that could be provided. Other questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Now, the bill here is talking about the University of Alaska. I'm curious, what about like Charter College? Does Charter College have any kind of similar arrangement with any school districts that we know of, or any other college for that matter, that would provide the opportunity for a high school student in Alaska to take dual credit?
This is Dr. Lair, through the chair. I am not in a position to answer that. The bill as written was really focused on the University of Alaska. Perhaps Senator Stevens could speak to the intent there, but you know, we've been really focusing obviously with the university and our relationship with districts.
Mr. Lampkin or Senator Stevens?
Yes, if I can comment on that. You know, the University of Alaska is a part of the state of Alaska, and we have no control over the campus. In fact, certainly, if that were possible, that'd be okay. But what this bill does really is to compel the University of Alaska. We can't compel anybody else. We can compel the University of Alaska to bring more districts into this, to work with school districts, to develop this middle college program. And I just want to say that Dr. Lair has been just stalwart throughout this entire process, and as well as Dr. Bishop in helping folks understand this. So that's a very important issue to realize, that we only have control over the University of Alaska, and they've done a great job. There are many districts that are looking into this. You mentioned speaking with Commissioner or Superintendent in Kodiak, and that's true. I want to go back to what Representative Vance said, because I think it's a very important issue, is to realize a student develops enormous confidence when they are in a college class. As a professor, I retired 22 years ago now, and taught for 25 years at the university, and occasionally had a student come from the high school that we had programmed to do that before this program was ever available. But occasionally a student would sign up for one of my regular classes, like maybe History of Alaska. And what you'd see is that a student coming in with adults, you know, mostly recent high school graduates, but also adults taking classes. Many teachers had to take my class because they're required to for recertification. But what I saw is this enormous confidence that was built over time. it's different than a high school class. In a college class, role is not taken too much. You know, you're responsible. If you don't want to show up, you don't show up. But there is a responsibility that develops, and I just am really, I couldn't stress enough, Reverend Vance, what confidence builder that is to have a student and to be a student and be in a class with adults.
Follow up. Thank you. I had the privilege of being involved in a dual credit program in high school, and I agree. It was an awesome opportunity. I want every Alaskan student to have that opportunity. And I know we're instructing the university to work with, any or all of the school districts. What about a school like Grace Christian School in Anchorage? Would the University of Alaska be able to offer a similar opportunity for students from that school?
I don't know the answer to that. Tim, do you have any comment?
For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. The scope of Senate Bill 32 as written is intended to provide a model for public schools with public dollars. I can't say that it would preclude a private school in negotiating with the University of Alaska. That would be a question I defer to Dr. Lehr. That's possible, but I'm not aware of such a relationship that might exist. Similarly, I suppose it's possible, for example, with Alaska Pacific University, which is a private institution, could possibly negotiate with Anchorage School District, for example, but that too I would defer to Dr. Bishop to see if such a thing occurs. But that is certainly outside of the scope of the model that's built in this bill.
Follow up. But it is not your intention to preclude those kinds of arrangements through this bill, is it?
No, certainly not at all. But again, realizing with a private institution, it would be difficult because we're dealing with state dollars. We're using the basic student dollars that every student gets, and providing those monies are used by the school district to get these classes to the kids.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I believe this question is for Dr. Bishop. Page 3 of the bill down at line 26 references national standards for awarding dual credit. If you would please, can you explain what the prevailing or present standard is so I can take a look at that? Thank you.
This is Dina Bishop, and I believe I was unmuted, so thank you. I can address that as well as the former question if you'd like. So the utilization of the national standards basically is wrapped around, and we could locate that for you, really that these courses are credit bound. Dr. Lehr spoke to them, that they're not especially asterisked or anything that says a child took these, as a younger student. So that's on the college side. But the idea of dual credit means that they also meet each side of the partnership has to accept that credit. And frankly, I found the most difficult side isn't the university side, it's my own, because we have beliefs about what should and shouldn't be. And so we've crosswalked all of the UAA courses to our district. I did the same thing when I was in MATSU, is crosswalk those standards to be sure that that is actually happening. Because the state of Alaska, of course, has the Alaska standards, and our graduation requirements ensure that students have met those standards. So we have to do that study to ensure that we have the documentation needed to say that if you took English 111, you have met the requirements for one of our English courses to meet the requirements of the statutory requirements through the state of Alaska. So it's basically this chain links together. But we've done the necessary work to do that. I hope that answers the question, but the prior question in regard to private is we welcome, see that the beauty of this is that Alaska money is going to Alaska students, and it doesn't matter where you went to school prior to this time. And so students have to be enrolled in ASD to receive the state funding to be able to turn around and then pay it to UAA. And so we have had private school students enroll with us And some of them still keep a foot in the private school, but also enroll with us to be able to do this program. And it's paid for them as well. So the benefit does benefit the students, but they would be enrolled with us. As far as private schools, there is a statute that really speaks to public school funds going to private institutions. And so there are some provisions that you work around. There's four different meters that you have to assess whether it's appropriate by law. But certainly we have homeschool and other dollars that a student would take an independent course at a private college. And it doesn't, but still get credit. So you really have to meet the letter of the law, and then it's totally possible. But you have to really study that and make sure that your program is set up to meet those requirements. But as was stated, it doesn't necessarily preclude you. It's probably just very different than how a public institution can work with a public institution utilizing public funds. And really the design of this program was kind of a mastering that we didn't want to, we already paying for education, so this dual credit, let's utilize the funds we put into education to get these kids a jump start. And that's why it's called an Alaska Middle College School, because our funding formula funds schools.
Mr. Lampkin?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, also in follow-up to clarify as regards the national standards reference on page 3, lines 18 through 31. I recall in the history and the making of this bill, which, by the way, has been several years in the making, that language actually came from the University of Alaska in the context of preserving their accreditation. We're talking about students that, in this instance, if the course is not taught on a UA campus, let's say, for example, it's a school district facility, that the content, the instructor, the curriculum is all approved standards, so that the credit that the University of Alaska is then giving to that student, it does not jeopardize their accreditation. And I'm sure Dr. Lair will confirm that for us.
Dr. Lair, do you have any additional comment on the subject?
Yes, thank you. One of the things, following up on Mr. Lampkin's comments, this was part of this is another ongoing kind of program that we've done is that, as a dual enrollment opportunity, we have approved high school teachers to teach university classes in high schools as well. And this is a different type of partnership in dual enrollment, dual credit, that we've had for many, many years. And so those teachers must meet the requirements that we have for our teachers, and their curriculum must follow our curriculum in order for us to award that credit to meet the national standards of our accrediting body. So the language there in that part of the statute is really to reflect that these classes will be taught at the college level and meet those requirements that we are required to meet by the Department of Education. Although I don't know all, and just follow up on the earlier question, I don't know, the funding sources for all of the schools out there across the state, but I was just looking at our virtual middle college. And again, this is the online program that has over 40 participants. And one of those is Monroe Catholic High School here in Fairbanks. And I was just seeing, but most of them are public school districts out there, but with our middle college, virtual middle college, there's nothing to preclude any school district, any approved school district from reaching out to the university to discuss a pathway for students in their school to participate in our program.
Thank you. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're getting close to the hour of 4:00, when my understanding is we have a finance subcommittee that fires up. What I'd like to do is open public testimony briefly, as that was noticed today. I say briefly, well, hereby opening public testimony, because I don't see anybody online, and I'm pretty sure I don't see anybody in the room, unless Ms. Perman has another hat she wants to wear. So we're closing public testimony for House Bill 32, we'll go to more questions in a second. I do want to set an amendment deadline, though, for 5 p.m. Tuesday. on this piece of legislation. So let the committee be advised of that, and we're going to go at ease briefly. And also let the record reflect that, I guess, you know, sort of eminent domain style thinking here. I noted that public testimony for House Bill 32 that closed. In fact, I meant to refer to Senate Bill 32, which is the piece of legislation before us. Let's take one more question and then set the bill aside for the day. Representative Eastman, I think you may have had a question.
Yeah, my question deals with two things, really. If you have a student that is enrolled in this program and they change school districts, like you have a family that moves from Anchorage out to the Mat-Su and they want to enroll in the Mat-Su school district, I'm just wondering, I guess they're not going to necessarily change going to the classes because the classes aren't in either place per se. Is there going to be a challenge with their transcript, with that sort of thing, if they're halfway through a semester and they change school districts to another school district, that sort of thing? So I'm sure that's come up before, so I just wanted to see how that is typically handled.
Mr. Lampkin?
For the record, Tim Lampkin, Staff Center Stevens. So this model is not intended to micromanage instances. Life happens. I think you'll find that it's pretty well articulated that the students are treated like college-level students. They've demonstrated that they can fulfill the rigor of the courses. I'm sure that the MOUs, and a few of which that are in the packet as they are developed with the university and between school districts, can have mitigating factors included in those contracts for instances such as family moves between students. I don't believe that the bill would necessarily need to be that prescriptive, but that would likely be contained in the MOUs, and with that, I would perhaps punt as well to Dr. Lehr.
Dr. Lehr, any further comment on the subject?
Yes, through the chair, we'd have to look, obviously, on a case-by-case basis, but if a student was in the UAA Anchorage ASD program in English and transferred to Mat-Su, you know, we'd have to look at a course in the Mat-Su if we were doing the face-to-face for them to participate in. But they're both UAA classes. They're both UAA courses. And so they would still meet the same requirements. But it would be something we'd have to look at a case-by-case basis as we would go forward. If the student's in a virtual program online, that would be easier because they wouldn't have to change the course that they're in if they change districts.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Well, with that, we'll set Senate Bill 32 aside. Thank you very much, Mr. Lampkin and Senator Stevens, as well as Drs. Bishop and Lehr for joining us. And timekeeping note, the Finance Subcommittee scheduled to start at 4 o'clock, incidentally, is chaired by the sponsor of the other bill noticed today. So we'll do a little bit of rearranging, and I think Finance Subcommittee may start later today. Take a brief at ease and let us change out presenters. But thank you very much, Senator Stevens, for joining us. We're at ease. And we're back on the record, 4 o'clock on the nose. And before us is the second item of today's agenda, House Bill 37 from Representative Wool. Representative Wool, Mr. Alper. Staff Rep. Wool, welcome back, I guess we could say, to the committee. Flashbacks, I'm sure. And the floor is yours for House Bill 37.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the House State Affairs Committee. My name is Representative Adam Wool from Fairbanks, District 5, and with me is my staffer, Ken Alper, who is working with me on this bill and has a lot of deep knowledge of issues relating to taxes and other things. So he will be here answering questions and helping me present. But in the interest of time, I will try to go through the background somewhat quickly and then get into the meat of the bill and discussion afterwards. House Bill 37 is a bill that does two things. It has a PFD formula rewrite, and it has an income tax, a revenue component. So it It was designed basically to help balance our fiscal situation in that we need revenue and we do need to reformulate the PFD, in my opinion, to something that is sustainable in the long term, as opposed to the statutory one we have so far. Where we are now, oil prices fell in 2014. As you all know, we made some major budget cuts. 20% of our operating budget was cut between 2015 and 2018, plus a large part of the capital budget. We have restructured how we fund government with the passage of SB 26. Instead of using oil to fund government, as we did previously for many decades, we now use a draw of the total value of the permanent fund, which is approximately $3 billion. Oil has dropped precipitously. Two things that we haven't done yet are changing the PFD formula, which many people in this building and on the third floor agree must be done. We are not following that statute, so we need to rewrite the formula to a sustainable amount that we can afford now and into the future, and new revenues to fill any gaps. Moving right along, 2021 committee process. This bill has been heard in Ways and Means. Judiciary, during one of the special sessions, heard it, and the working class, the Permanent Fund Working Group, Fiscal Policy Working Group, I'll get it right, also heard a presentation of this bill during the summer. So, like I said, we have revenue declines, we made some budget cuts, we have a PONV, we have some structural deficits, and that for many years we were taking out a savings to pay down, to pay a full to balance the budget, basically. And this year we've had some other ways to balance the budget. Lack of resolution on the PFD, and looking at taxes, Alaska is the lowest tax state in the country. So now we're going to look at things to look at going forward, a sales tax versus an income tax as far as a broad-based tax, how much revenue do we need, and I will go over some details of the bill. Going to the next slide, we have a graph that many of you have seen. It shows revenue at the background curve and budget as the straight up and down bars. I don't know if you want to add anything to this, Ken?
For the record, Ken Alper, Staff Representative Wool. I know we're time constrained. Many of you have seen versions of these graphs before. The key is if you see white behind these bars, that means there were deficits those years. We had more spending than we had revenue. So FY 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, we had multi-billion dollar deficits that were resolved through the use of savings. The dark blue wedges on the right-hand side in the background, that's the POMV draw that began in fiscal year 2019.
This next slide shows the savings accounts and their balances. The big blue bar is the CBR, and the green bar above that is the SBR, Statutory Budget Reserve, and Constitutional Budget Reserve. As you can see towards the right end of the graph, we've drained the CBR almost to nothing. SBR is at nothing. The bottom colors are some other accounts that we don't generally draw into for budgetary things like PCE, higher ed, and so on. But you can see the slope of the curve. We built up these savings accounts, and then we drained them. So now we have to deal with that lack of savings, and that's how we were balancing the budget. So last year when this bill was introduced, forecast the next several budgets, we could balance them, and we would have a little bit of residual money left over, equal to about a $500 PFD, or in budgetary terms, $300 million. So this bill makes two major changes to balance the budget. We restructured the PFD for around $1,000 to $1,200 per person, and we raised revenue approximately $500 million. Again, if you want a higher PFD, you'll need more revenue, and those two levers can be moved. But I want to emphasize that they're not linked in that the taxes are needed for a PFD or vice versa. PFD is a budget item. Taxes are a revenue item. But we have other revenues, and we have other budget items.
And Representative Wool, Mr. Apple, just a quick interjection and sort of informational question. In the graph showing state accounts, there was PCE, higher ed fund. Can you just refresh me / the committee? We went through the whole sort of snafu around the reverse sweep last year. I can't actually remember what ultimately, I mean, there was a lawsuit on PCE, the plaintiffs prevailed over the governor, but what's the current status of, say, the higher ed fund, for instance, or was the sweep reversed? What do these other accounts look like?
Mr. Chairman. The higher ed fund was paid out to the recipients last year per statute. It was then swept into the CBR, and in this year's budget, those same scholarships were put into general fund as a budget item. Now, there's a lawsuit similar to the PCE lawsuit stating, trying to decide if that PCE, the higher ed actually was sweepable. So that's in litigation right now. If it's not sweepable, it will go back as an existing fund. And if it was deemed sweepable, it will stay in the CBR, that approximately $400 million.
So it's a little afield, but there's potentially going to be a lawsuit, assuming there's an interested party or plaintiff, for potentially or conceivably every single fund that the administration deemed sweepable.
If I can, Mr. Chairman, Ken Alper here. This graph hasn't been updated for FY22 yet. The orange bar at the bottom there, the higher ed fund, theoretically is about a little less than $400 million will be swept into the CBR. So the same graph in the next year, the orange will be gone and the blue will be slightly thicker. Unless the lawsuit goes in the way of the plaintiffs, then the orange bar will stay and the blue bar will be a little smaller.
Okay, yeah. This is a field, but it's just striking to me how inane and destructive and dumb that is. But please proceed.
Thank you. What's different since last year? Well, basically, the permanent fund has grown quite a bit. We had a record year on the stock market, 25 to 30% returns. So its value went from $66 billion to $82 billion. That was not really expected to happen. So the PONB draw, which was also increased substantially, $150 million this year. And if you go out to 2028, that increase is $830 million. So the permanent fund grew, therefore the 5% draw grows. And again, the 5% isn't a year by year, it's a five-year rolling average. So it's actually about 4.6% in aggregate. The other thing that happened is oil prices went up to almost $90 a barrel from a projected price of about 60. So we have a lot of extra revenue. Again, a little over $1 billion more dollars in oil revenue has come into the state coffers. So, and federal money from the COVID pandemic, the federal government has given us about $1 billion of sort of discretionary funds. We used approximately $500 million last year. We're slated to use approximately $500 million this year. That's to be determined because we're working on the budget right now. There's also many billions in non-discretionary funds that came through to the state. So between those three things, our state coffers are in pretty good shape right now. So then the question is, so do we still need revenue? And a lot of people are saying, wow, we have a lot of money right now. We don't need any revenue. Let's just we're living large. But even the governor's 10-year plan, which includes a 50-50 dividend, which means taking half of the POMB draw and putting that towards dividends and the other half towards state services, even the governor's 10-year plan has a deficit starting next year in the FY2024 budget. Ledge Finance has an even different take on it because they have different assumptions about the budget than the governor does. And Ledge Finance thinks that the governor's budget was undercounted by $200 to $400 million per year, which even increases this deficit. Starting FY23, it's $49.7 million, going up into several hundred million, $415 million by FY31. But even the Ledge Finance budget, although it makes different assumptions than the governor's, it uses a 2% inflation rate going forward. It says there's going to be a supplemental budget of $50 million a year. It includes things like school bond debt, fully funding school bond debt, and other things that the governor doesn't have. So that increases the deficit going out forward. But let's not forget, the market had a great year. That's probably not going to happen for a long time. And as many experts have come and told us, we could have a negative year coming up. Cowen predicts 6.2% going forward. There's another financial group we saw from in finance that predicts maybe even 5%. And this is a 10-year projection at 5%. Price of oil, no one really knows what that's going to do. It was 60, it went up to 90, it could go back to 60, it could go down to 50 over the next 10 years, no one can really predict what oil will do. Lastly, oil production, which is the next page. The graph on the left, the colored one, is the history of North Slope oil in Alaska. It peaked in 1988 at about 2 million barrels per day. And as you can see from 1988 to the right side of that graph, which is 2021, it's been on decline. It's sort of flattened out towards the end, which is typical for a large field, but it is on the decline. Now, the smaller, the square off to the right, the rectangle, is the forecast from Department of Natural Resources going forward. There's four bars. The middle two are their sort of higher probability bars. The black one has a slight increase, and the blue one has a slight decrease. The gray ones, upper and lower, are sort of the extremes, and they run a lot of probability modeling and statistical modeling, looking at all the potential fields, all the different oil companies that are out there. So their overall projection says that oil is probably going to be relatively flat over the next 10 years, approximately 500,000 barrels a day. Their price prediction going forward, I think, was $71. I don't know what their 10-year projection is. Maybe Ken knows. But in other words, oil is unpredictable. And we do try to predict it, but we're not always right. So going forward, the question is, do we need revenue? My answer is yes, we do. We might not need it this year, but looking forward, it would be prudent. The other thing I didn't mention was, yes, once a major bill passes, it's going to take 18 months to start collecting revenue. So let's say we think in 2024 we're going to have a difference of $200 million. We better start now in enacting these laws. People say we need to diversify the economy, and Alaska hasn't done that. I'm going to say we have done that. We just haven't diversified our revenue. For in the 70s, 80s, and mid-1990, GDP tracked oil and gas largely. Then our economy started modernizing. We started adding other sectors and developing more sectors like healthcare, tourism, transportation, financial services. So our GDP has gone up quite a bit, but our oil and gas is a much smaller portion of it. So what I believe is that we and others, we should have our revenue track GDP. As our economy grows, our revenue should grow. If a big company moves to Anchorage or somewhere like that and has a bunch of employees and brings in jobs, that's great. But if their kids are going to school and they're driving on our roads and they're using our courts and perhaps our prisons, unfortunately, that costs money, and the state has to pay for that. And how does these companies reimburse the state for these services? Unless there's a tax, they don't. Or unless they're a big corporation, we'll pay some corporate income tax, but it's not that much. So we want industries to come here. We want server farms and alternative energy and mines and such. But we want them to pay back to the state because they end up using our services. Roads and schools are expensive, as we all know, public health and so on. So we need a revenue that tracks GDP. This next slide shows all the different sectors in our economy that have grown from 1997 to 2015. As you can see, the curve goes up. And these are the non-petroleum sectors, all kinds of industries in there. This looks at Alaska relative to other states in the country, where we are as far as how taxed we are, including local taxes such as sales tax and property tax. We are the lowest at 5.8%. Next up is Wyoming. And if you include the PFD as a negative tax, which some people may not want to do, but if a tax is money an individual gives to the government, the PFD is money the government gives to the individual. So it's an inverse tax, which even reduces our rate down to 1.7%. Looking at all the states in the union, if we raised our tax by $700 million a year, which is more than this bill suggests, this bill is more of a $500 million, even at $700 million, we'd be number two. Again, if we use the negative tax concept, we'd be back to the lowest in the country.
And I can't make out the fine print. Is that New Hampshire as the other 49th, I guess, state?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Ken Alpert. New Hampshire is the second lowest state. They, similar to us, don't have a state sales tax, and they have a partial state income tax. They have a fair amount of local, they have a state property tax and a lot of local taxation.
Yeah.
Next slide would sales Oh, did I miss one? No, we're good. Sales versus income, often a debate that will be heard around this building if we get that far. This is a study that shows if you make under $100,000, you pay more with a sales tax than with an income tax. And
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Tarr.
Pardon me, it's hard to interject when you're on the phone. I do want to point out that in this note, it says that this sales tax was evaluated with exemptions for food at home, healthcare, education, and shelter. And I don't think that's true, only having been the one who worked on the sales tax. Most of the evaluations were done with one with no exemptions at all.
Hi, Representative Tarr, through the chair, Ken Alper here. This was from analysis that ITEP, the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, brought to the Ways and Means Committee. I don't believe they were looking at Representative Tarr's bill particularly. I think it was more of a generic sales tax with certain assumptions that the analyst made. And the note's correct, so far as I know, to the analyst's analysis.
Our next slide is a breakdown of incomes in Alaska. We had more subdivisions, but we just lumped them together, so into four quarters, roughly. The blue is anyone who makes under $25,000, which is 32% of Alaskans. The red is 25 to 50. Added together, that's 55%. Over half of Alaskans make under $50,000. There's a lot of people in the low to middle income bracket. The other two brackets are 50 to 100 and over 100. So a fifth of the Alaskan makes over 100, and then 50 to 100 is another quarter. People have said, well, if we have an income tax, not that many people will pay it. Now, I want to address that claim by looking at the number of federal tax returns that have come from Alaska. This is 2017. You have the single filers, the joint filers, which is two or maybe more, but definitely two, head of household and other. So total filers is about 350,000. If each joint filer is two, that adds another 125,000. We're up to 474,000 filers. Our adult population in 2020 was 550. That's 87% of Alaskans are paying, of adults are paying, filing for taxes. So 87% is certainly more than half. A lot of people say, well, only half the people pay taxes. That's not true. And if a joint filer for any reason is more than two, if they have a dependent living with them in the house, then that would raise that number even up a little more. Details of this bill. Basically, we're starting with a PFD formula that uses 10% of the POMV draw. So we have the POMV draw is 5% of the total value. We're going to take 1/10 of that 5% and combine that with 30% of oil royalties. So it's a combination. It's not just a straight POMV draw. It adds a component of oil. And the reason I do this is because our economy is heavily reliant on oil, as we all know. And as oil goes up, this would cause the PFD check to go up a little bit. If oil goes down, PFD would go down. The reason I did this because my concern is if oil were to precipitously drop, either now or in the future or at some point, the pipeline is 45 years old. And if in another 45 years it's not pumping oil, or if another 45 years the world is on, you know, fusion energy or other kinds of alternative energy, that oil isn't needed as much as it is now for any reason. If our oil revenue goes way down, I'm concerned that, and if we're obligated to pay a large PFD, we won't be able to do it. So this ties a little more than half currently of the PFD to the oil revenue. When this bill was introduced in fall 2020, using the fall 2020 prices, this would have been $834 PFD. Currently, it's gone up to $1,148 based on the recent oil price increase. If oil production were to go up, the dividend would go up even more if one of the big fields up north came online. Permanent fund changes. Other changes this bill would make, instead of the 25% royalty pre-79 and 50% post-79, this would just make it all 25%, mostly for cleaning it up, and this would put 75 current prices, about $75 million into the general fund. We also repeal the Amaretta Hess set aside, which is $420 million, which produces $27 million a year. That would also go, which currently goes to the capital income fund. That would go into the general fund. If anyone has any questions about the deeper workings of that, we're happy to answer it. But you've probably heard reference to Amaretta Hess in the past.
Have you encountered any opposition from any quarters in terms of moving Amaretta Hess off the books?
Mr. Chairman, I have not heard any opposition to that.
No, Mr. Chairman, my only observation will be there's a lot of permanent fund bills out there. This is the only one that goes to this path. It's a little bit controversial because the original court case that set aside that money, the jury pool from 1990 is very different from the Alaska population today. There is a built-in sunset that eventually, when enough of those people have passed, this thing will go away in another 20, 30, 40 years. We're just, for simplicity's sake, we put it in the bill to get rid of it now.
Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, want to Rep. Wohl or, I'm drawing a blank, sorry.
Can't
I know, help. But last name. Nope. Thank you, Mr. Alper. Isn't deferred maintenance under Amaretta Hess?
Through the chair, Representative Story, that the $27 million annual money that comes out of this $420 million pot goes to the place called the Capital Income Fund. For the last several budget cycles, it has been used for deferred maintenance. That's been a funding source for it. And that's in past years, it was more like sort of capital projects of interest to co-chairs of finance. It's been used for different things at different points in history. But yes, it's fair to say that for the last several years, that $27 million has been designated towards deferred maintenance.
Thank you.
Moving right along, revenues and impacts from this bill. I missed one. Oh, yeah, income tax. Let's talk about that. The other changes are this bill would propose a 2.5% flat tax on the adjusted gross income, which is standard used amongst many states. Includes all your income, wages, self-employment, et cetera, and you can adjust it to include retirement contributions, student loan interest, but it doesn't have a lot of other deductions like mortgage interest. This bill would also have a standard deduction of your first $12,550 if you're single, $18,800 if you're head of household, and $25,000 for a joint filer. PFD payments are non-taxable. What this does with the standard deductions, and I feel this is an important point, many people say, well, the PFD is great. Some people don't need it, and certainly lower-income people definitely need it and have come to rely on it, and I definitely support that. What this does is it says applying an income tax to everyone is fine, but if you're low income, you need to keep most of your PFD and you shouldn't pay an income tax. You need that money. So this deduction, what it does is if you're a head of household and you have a $25,000 deduction and you make $25,000, basically your income is zero. You'll pay zero taxes. You'll retain all of your PFD. So this is a slight form of means testing where lower income people will essentially lower their income and then won't have to pay taxes, or certainly as much. This bill was a similar type bill was looked at in the LB&A committee, and they used a 2.5% income tax rate with a standard deduction of 10 and 20. Our standard deduction was a little higher. It tracks the federal numbers of standard deductions. And so this is approximated to be $545 million in revenue with our current bill. The next table shows what different groups and individuals, families, et cetera, would pay. I know there's a lot of numbers up there and a lot of squares. I'll just focus on a couple. A single parent, which is a head of household with one child. So there'd be two dividends coming to the house. But the head of household can deduct $18,000 from their income. If they make $25,000, which, as we saw, over a quarter of Alaskans make $25,000 or less. So if you make that amount, your tax would be $100. So of the dividends you receive, according to this formula, you would retain $2,198. if you're married couple with, is that no kids, making $50,000, your tax would be $565. So of your dividends, you would retain $731. And it's not in this presentation, but the bill would allow, when you file for your PFD, you could check a box and says, I'm going to use the PFD to pay my taxes. So in that case, this individual who had $565 in taxes, this married couple, they would click that box and they would get a PFD check, but it would be for a lower amount, but they would still get a check. They wouldn't have to write a check to the state and then get a check back. They would just get the check back. And married family, married, two kids, $200,000. Let's say each parent made $100,000, and they got four PFD checks, the two parents and the two kids. Again, they would net $334. They would not pay any net taxes to the state. They click on the box, they'd get a check for $334. Conclusions. $2,500 dividend as proposed by the governor, which is 50-50, although I think it's slightly higher than that now, I feel, and others, is risky going forward. Even the governor's plan shows a deficit very near future. A $500 dividend, which was sort of the residual PFD without any added revenue at the is too low. I feel it's too low. I think many Alaskans feel it's too low, and I don't think that would be acceptable.
I have a point of clarification. You feel that's too low.
A $500 PFD?
Yes.
I feel that's too low.
Thank you.
Thank you for putting me on the record.
You're welcome.
That being said, I think we need new revenue. And I think what this bill does, two pieces are roughly equal in size and impact. Again, what I want to emphasize is, as I'm not linking the tax to the PFD. The PFD is part of our budget, just like health and social services, education, public safety, corrections. They're all budget items. The PFD is a budget item. I don't think it should be as large as it's been proposed right now. Our revenue, we have oil, we have PONV, we have other incomes as some other taxes, timber, fishing, mining, they're very low. And I think we need a broad-based tax, and I think the income tax is the best way to do that. An income tax would track our GDP. If Amazon moves to Anchorage with 20,000 jobs, the state would receive extra revenue to cover for schools and roads and public health that those extra 20,000 people would bring. Also, a couple things about the budget looking forward. The governor's taking a flat budget, adding 1.5% inflation. Ledge Finance is taking a flat budget, adding a few things in 2% inflation. But as many of you have heard in many committees, we have other needs besides a flat budget. The BSA, K-12 education, hasn't been increased in a long time, and schools are hurting. Medicaid costs are definitely going to raise, I believe, faster than 1%, which I think is the governor's projection. Medical costs themselves go up. So when you look at PERS and TERS, the biggest cost for them is medical, and it's raising at a very high rate. Capital budget has been underfunded for years. We have needs in deferred maintenance at the university and school buildings all around the state. So I believe the budget will need to be increased in various ways. Defined benefits. There's some defined benefits bills going around. We need to recruit and retain public employees. And I think defined benefits will probably end up costing money. So to build up the budget isn't a bad thing, but I think we need a bigger revenue portfolio, and I think a broad-based tax is part of it. And with that, I think we've concluded, and maybe you have time for a couple discussion points.
And Representative Cochran's off to LBNA meeting, but let's see if there's a question or two. We can entertain them, but appreciate you running through that presentation, Representative Wohl. Questions from the committee? A studious silence. Representative Story.
Thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins, and thank you, Rep. Wohl and Mr. Alper. I think there's a lot of information. It's good and really succinct, really, when you put the presentation together. And I would think that one thing that is really Alaskans have to weigh, and us as legislators have to weigh, is also you started to list some things that would benefit by this approach. And what I mean benefit I think about that stable fiscal plan that you talked about, because if I remember in other presentations, that's a really gain to our economy, that we are saying businesses would invest more, have more growth if they knew that we had a fiscal plan. And that is critical to where a lot of us want to grow Alaska. And then mentioning the needs that you did for our schools, for healthcare, for our capital budgets, which are really important for all our infrastructure needs. Those things I think we have to weigh as Alaskans, because we would gain through this measure approximately $600 million in new revenue and new investments, and most of all, I think, providing some assurances to quality of life measures that our education investment can grow. And so thank you for this.
Thank you, Representative Story, through the chair. I appreciate those comments. And yes, I didn't highlight that the stability and predictability that a balanced fiscal plan would bring to attract businesses and residents and so on. And I feel all those things are very important. I had one other thought, and it's escaped me, but maybe if I think of it in the next couple seconds. Mr. Alpert, did you have something?
While Representative Wool is thinking, I just wanted to get a comment out there, Mr. Chairman, on the fiscal note. If members have a chance to look at it, there's an oddity in there because the bill, as written, it was introduced last year, had an effective date of January 1st, 2022. That was taken literally by the Department of Revenue, as if the bill were to pass, it would be implemented retroactively. So there's some weird stuff in the first year of the fiscal note. Don't take it seriously. Clearly, if there's desire to move this bill, we'd be highly amenable to making it take effect in the future sometime.
Great. Thank you. Representative Tart, any questions?
I do, but in the interest of time, I'll hold off. And I am going to follow up on the sales tax piece of it so I can share that information with the committee.
Sounds good. We'll look out for that. Well, Representative Vance, excuse me.
I do have one question for the maker of this bill. On page 14, the purple writing at the top says the black bar represents $700 million in new and increased taxes based on House Income Tax Bill of 2017. Is this bill very similar to that, or how does it differ? To that original bill, I mean.
Yeah, Representative Vance through the chair. No, the bill that was passed in 2017 is different. This is a flat tax, 2.5%. That bill was a progressive tax. So as your income went up, the percentage of tax you paid went up, much like the federal tax. This bill is just straight up flat, 2.5%. So that number, $700 million, was used on this graph simply because it was sort of similar to $550, but for no other reason than that.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Vance, this graph was used originally in the analysis of that bill that the House addressed in 2017. I will say that a lot of the technical language inside this bill about definitions of income and rules and implementation pieces are similar to the bill that the House passed in 2017, but the tax rates themselves, who's paying and how much, are very, very different.
Thank you. And we'll do a last question, having gone all the way around the horn, to Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I like this slide in laying out some different things. I'm just kind of curious, though, as to the concept behind this slide. So when we talk about taxes, are we talking about, for the purpose of this slide, I mean, are we talking about when something is taken and then used by government, spent by government, goes to a government program, for example, is that the kind of tax we're talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, yes, income tax, sales tax, property tax, monies that are paid from an individual to a governing body, and then that governing body uses it for schools, police, roads, those kind of things.
Follow up. I've heard much talk in the legislature about the fact that the oil belongs to the people. You know what the slide would look like if we adjusted for the oil being taken from the people and then given to government, for example, or very little of that ends up back in the people's pocket, for sure. So if we were to consider that in the sense that we consider these other taxes, do you know how that slide would change?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think I know where you're going with this. I don't have the exact data. I think there's some other considerations. If you're going to say the oil belongs to the people and the oil companies pay tax, and I don't know how that would figure in as well. And I know there's I know the argument of the oil belong to the people, and then that money doesn't come back through the people. I'd have to develop that argument a little more and work some numbers to get back to you on that. But I'd be happy to do that.
I'd be very interested. Thank you. Yeah.
And if I may, in closing, Representative Tompkins, first of all, thank you for allowing me to go over. I know we have a Department of Administration overview that we will be very brief with as well, and I thank the committee members. I remember the last thing I was going to say, as far as the budget and stability, and more towards what Representative Story said, which is this: people want stability, predictability, and so on. Our budgets have been cut, as I said, for 5 years to the tune of 20% operating budget. And as you've noticed recently, K-12 is projected to be a slight cut going forward. The university has been cut drastically over the last few years, although last year it was cut $5 million, and this year I think there's going to be a $4 million add projected from the governor. So relatively flat, but a big cut recently. The things that are going up are corrections and public safety. So we're spending more on prisons and cops and less on schools. And I think going forward, if there's more revenue and our budget becomes stable and we can build up pre-K and K-12 and stuff like that, I think those investments will ultimately lower the budget for corrections and police. And I hope we are able to live in a place where we don't have to spend as much on prisons and police, and we can have an educated working class of people that are productive and can build our GDP.
Thank you for those closing comments.
Thank you,
Representative Wall. We're going to adjourn. Just a quick note, we've got two bills on political contribution limits up on Tuesday, and then on Thursday, piece of legislation relating to Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation appointments from Representative Josephson, and then piece of legislation from Representative Proctor relating to PFDs and contributions to the general fund. Thank you, Sophia, Lydia, Jeff, very much. Thank you, Representative Wolf, for joining us. And at 4:38, we're adjourned.